I would like to tell you that for the examination on Wednesday, you may bring to class the books that are on your assignment in connection with the examination. But please don't bring any other books or writings. We were discussing Locke, yes? I've already announced that. Please ask another student. I've been discussing Locke, and I would like to continue that discussion. Will you please quiet down so we can proceed? Men live in a state of nature. By that, Locke means not necessarily men who live in a forest, in a wilderness, although that may be a condition, but it's a condition subsequent. It's not the basic condition defining the state of nature. The state of nature is a condition in which men live without a government, without a state, without a political organization, which means that each man has to look after himself, but he is not without guidance. In that condition, he has reason to guide him. Reason provides him with the laws of nature, so that life in the condition where there is no government, there is no state, need not necessarily be brutal. It need not be a state of war of man against man. Life may be brutal under a government. There may be a resort to force and violence, even though men live in a political society. Men can live at peace even though there is no government, there is no political society. The definition of the state of nature is the one which provides the law of reason as the guide for conduct. But outside, as differentiated from Moore's utopia, outside of a political society. As when Locke talks about the state of nature, he means men who are guided by reason in a condition in which there is no political organization. Now, by reason, by the use of reason, men can learn the moral laws, which are laws of nature, which are grounded by their creator in man's own social nature. He is social by nature, and therefore has to guide him reason, by the use of which he can discover the moral laws that should operate for men in society. Now, what reason discovers in that condition are laws that are made by nature or by nature's God, not by men. There is no organization of men for any purpose, any political purpose at least. Now, the opposite of law, moral law, any kind of law, is force. Force or violence. Also opposite to law in the Lockean sense is license. That is, men acting as they will, not guided by reason, but simply guided by their willfulness. Action according to reason, when action is according to reason, then it is action according to law. And such action Locke defines as liberty. Liberty is the opposite of license. Where there is license, there is no law. Where there is liberty, there is law. Liberty is an ordered type of action. It is circumscribed. It is fenced in. It is channeled by reason. When a man acts according to license, he does what he wants. What he wants may be contrary to the law of reason. But when he acts according to liberty, then he acts in accordance with what the law of reason directs. In a state of nature, then, men have law and have liberty according to that law. Now, when they may act according to license, and that creates a problem that we'll come to in just a few moments. Now, nature, reason, law, and liberty are all intertwined. Yes? What was that? Well, I don't want to interrupt my trend of thought here with that. Please hold that. This is a tricky business here, and I'm trying to move along step by step. So we'll come to your question, but hold it in abeyance. In section 63, Locke writes, "The freedom then of man and liberty of acting according to his own will is grounded on his having reason, which is able to instruct him in that law he's to govern himself by and make him know how far he is left to the freedom of his own will." As when reason directs his freedom of will, then he has liberty. Then he acts as a free man. To turn him loose to an unrestrained liberty before he has reason to guide him is not the allowing him the privilege of his nature to be free, but to thrust him out amongst brutes and abandon him to a state as wretched and as much beneath that of man as that of the brutes. So when a man acts as he wills without guidance from reason or the law of nature, which is reason, then he's reduced to the same state as brutes. Section 61, "Thus we are born free as we are born rational. As if we are rational, then we are free. Not that we have actually the exercise of either age that brings one, that is age that brings rationality, brings with it also freedom." And this is why small young children are under the guidance of their parents, he explains, because they have not yet attained the use of their reason. They are not fully rational. And so they may not be fully free. They become free when they become rational. In some ways, this is a Stoic conception put in quite other terms. Who is free? The man who is rational. Who is not free? The man who is not rational. The slave may be free because he may be rational. The master may not be free because he may not be rational. He may be a brute. So this is a use of liberty or freedom, which of course has been built into political theory very widely. It's inescapable from the development of political thought in the West. So it's not what a layman on the street might take to be free. He might think any restraint is a limitation on his freedom. Whereas Locke and most other philosophers, political theoreticians in the classical tradition would argue that to be completely without restraint is not to be free, but to be the very opposite of free. Now, in a state of nature, there is no government. There's no political organization. And here we come to one of the key problems developed by Locke and one of the key ideas. In that state of nature where there is no government, each man must execute the law of nature himself. He cannot call a policeman. There is no judge. There is no government to turn to. There is a law of nature. My neighbor violates that law of nature. He acts according to license and not according to liberty. And in that way, curtails my liberty, my rights. Now, the law of nature has to be enforced. What is the enforcement machinery? Simply that I have the right, given to me by that law of nature, to execute that law against anybody who violates it, against me or against my neighbors. Because if he violates that natural law against my neighbor, the next day he may do it against me. If he has no respect for the law of reason, for the law of nature, if he thinks he can do what he wants, today he does it to X, tomorrow he'll do it to Y, and the next day he'll come to me. And so when I see that he's doing it to X, I have a right to stop him. I have a right to punish him. And of course, X has that right in defense of himself, in defense of his own liberty, to execute the law against the miscreant. In transgressing, this is in paragraph 8, in transgressing the law of nature, the offender declares himself to live by another rule than that of common reason and equity, which is that measure God has set to the actions of men. That is the limits that God has fixed for their mutual security. And so he becomes dangerous to mankind. The tie which is to secure them from injury and violence being slighted and broken by him, which being a trespass against the whole species, that is, by implication, he's threatening all of mankind, because if he does it to one, he can do it to anybody else. So he is threatening humanity. But you have to hear a kind of a concept of a crime against humanity. A crime against an individual may, by implication, be a crime against humanity. Against the whole species and the peace and safety of the species, provided for by the law of nature. Every man, upon this score, by the right he has to preserve mankind in general, may restrain, or where it is necessary, destroy things noxious to them, that is poisonous, inimical to them, that is to mankind, and so bring such evil on anyone who has transgressed that law, as may make him repent, and thereby deter him, and by his example deter others from doing the like mischief. And in this case, and upon this ground, every man has a right to punish the offender and to be the executioner. of the law of nature. Now, but it is precisely at this point that Locke points out the inconvenience, as he calls it. It's not the only one, but it's a major one. The inconvenience of life in the state of nature, as where there is no state, there is no government. The inconvenience of that state. Because, for one thing, there is no provision made, and there cannot be, since there is no political organization, for any objective judgment in the case described. A man has to be a judge in his own case. I say X is doing something which he has no right to do. He's doing it to me, and he has no right to do it. I am the judge in my own case. But by that very same token, he is a judge also in his own case. And he takes another view of the matter. So you have a conflict, and you have a resort to force and violence. And what may happen is simply that might may overcome right. My adversary may, in fact, be right. I, however, may be the stronger man. So you have, as a result, might ruling rather than right. Force rather than reason. My license rather than this man's liberty. Or the reverse may be the case. So that this kind of so-called inconvenience is built into the situation that we're describing. Also, in addition to that, there's no limit on the punishment that I might administer to him, or he to me. Which means that passion, that hatred, that the feeling of revenge may control. And again, substitutes for reason. Again, no operation of law, but of license. What my neighbor might do to me might involve some exercise of control by me. But instead of using a delicate instrument, which may be all that may be necessary in that case, and all that the rule of reason might call for, I might approach it with a sledgehammer. And I might kill him, whereas all maybe he deserved was a reprimand. And there is no judge. There is no control. There is no objective statement of law which can make a decision between right and wrong, which can see to it that right rather than might would be operative, that reason rather than force, or liberty rather than license might be the test. And so it becomes necessary to form a civil government, a civil society, which in turn will lead to the establishment of a government and of a code of laws. The state of nature may be fine until one reaches this question of the execution of the law of nature or the law of reason. Now, in order to accomplish the establishment of a civil society, a civil order, men enter into an agreement among themselves, an agreement to move out of the state of nature into a civil society, the essence of which, though that's not the total story, but the essence of which is that each man at that point gives up his own right and power to execute the law. He's willing to have that power merged into a general congeries which will be vested in an agency. He voluntarily is willing to merge his small power into the general pool of the power to execute the law of nature. Now, this agreement is conditional upon all others agreeing in the same way. The agreement requires unanimity. A state comes into existence when all the inhabitants, we can't speak of them as citizens because they're not citizens before they form this agreement, but when they all agree, then the state comes into existence. What we would call in political theory today, the political state comes into existence with a monopoly on the power to execute the law. Now, after that, the citizens, they are now citizens of a state, need to agree on a government. And it is not clear from Locke whether this means that there are two separate agreements. First, the agreement to form a state, and then the agreement to form a government, or that analytically there are two steps, intellectually and conceptually, but not necessarily in time. But I think that philosophically, conceptually, there are two different steps. Let me explain this. Locke himself had lived through two revolutions. The Puritan Revolution, when Cromwell replaced the king after Charles I was beheaded. That was a revolution. And the Glorious Revolution of 1689, when James II was supplanted by William and Mary. Now, the governments changed, but the state didn't change. The English state remained. It survived these changes. And we've seen, of course, many such instances in history. We see them very often. In Latin America, revolutions take place very often. But the states remain. The revolutions are on the governmental level. So that there are two steps that politically, conceptually, need to be kept separate one from the other. After a revolution, during the revolution, and after the revolution, the basic, as we call it, social contract remains intact. People are still citizens of Peru or of Chile or of England or of whatever country. Now, the government comes into existence not by unanimous agreement, but by majority vote. Once a person has given his consent to the formation of a political state, after that, the state can function only on the basis of majority agreement. Otherwise, it would mean that every citizen would have a veto power, and that, of course, would be an impossible situation. He has a veto power insofar as his membership in the state is concerned. Now that means that if he doesn't want to be a member of the state, he can, as it were, stay out of it and find some place, if there is such a place, where he could live in a state of nature. Or if the state is already in existence, if he wants to move out of the state back into a condition of a state of nature, he can do that. Or he can go to some other state. The Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the United Nations Assembly in 1948, in Article 13, says that every person has a right to leave his state and to return to it if he wants to. This is the controversy with Russia today over the right of exit of Jews who want to emigrate from the USSR. The whole thing involves, as you see here, what was conceived of by Locke and has been stated to have been from that time on a fundamental right, is that a person does not have to be a member of the state in which he finds himself. If there is some other state that will permit him entry, he has a right to leave. Now, as long as he lives, however, in that state, whether he likes it or not, he is bound by the government of that state, by the laws of that state. This is section 96. For when any number of men have, by the consent of every individual, made a community, they have thereby made that community one body, with a power to act as one body, which is only by the will and the determination of the majority. As the state is one body, and how does the state act? It acts on the basis of the will and the determination of the majority. For that which acts any community being only the consent of the individuals of it, and it being necessary to that which is one body to move one way, it is necessary that the body should move that way, whether the greater force carries it, which is the consent of the majority. Or else it is impossible it should act or continue one body, one community, which the consent of every individual that united into it agreed that it should. And so everyone is bound by that consent to be concluded by the majority. There is no alternative to majority rule. Once the individuals are merged into one body or one political state. This is, of course, a very exciting and very fruitful conceptualization of the political process. And it's a process which is universal, which is visible universally without regard to the system that may be operative, whether it's democratic or a monarchy or a dictatorship, it doesn't matter. It seems to me that this kind of an analysis is one which is necessary to follow through. For example, I can see, and if you stop and think about it, I think you too would agree, that the trouble in Northern Ireland is that there is no basic social contract. This is not a quarrel over the government. It's a quarrel, it's a fight over whether or not the two elements in the society can live together in one state. And as long as they don't agree on that, they are at each other's throats. If you think of Vietnam as one country, not divided into northern and southern Vietnam, it's the same problem. And it's been in existence for a long time. The trouble with the Republic of South Africa is precisely this problem, where the majority who are blacks and the minority who are whites have not agreed on one state. They have not come together in a basic social contract. The Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which were overrun, literally overrun, by the Russians in the Second World War, are in the same predicament. They have been absorbed, assimilated into the USSR. But there's no agreement among them that that's where they want to be. So there's no social contract. And until recently, East Pakistan was in this condition. Now Bangladesh, where there was no agreement as to the basic community as to whether or not East Pakistan should be or should not be a part of West Pakistan, whether it should be or not be a separate state. And almost every day you read about other parts of the world, the other day, about Burundi and Rwanda in Africa with the conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsi tribes, or where they are, and live together under a common social contract. That's a very helpful conceptualization, it seems to me. Yes? Who or what? Oh, I don't want to get into draft dodging now. Look, let's try to understand this. Draft dodging is simply a violation of a law. It isn't that these people withdrew from the state. If they gave up their citizenship, then of course that's an indication that they pulled out of the state. It's not a question of a particular government or not. They can resign from being American citizens. Almost anybody can do that. There are procedures for it. If they didn't, then they simply violated a law, like any other law. Yes? I'm sorry, but... Of course, it's theoretical. If there isn't any state of nature to which you can go, then... You're stuck, except that you could resign from one state and go into another political state. Then you pledge allegiance to another state. You can leave the United States, give up your citizenship, become a Canadian or a Swede or whatever it is. Yes? I'm sorry, I didn't follow you. Yes. Does he see it as desirable? Yes, it's much more desirable. The civil society is much more desirable than the state of nature. Otherwise, men, as I said this the other day, men wouldn't give up if their membership in the state of nature. If the state of nature is so desirable, and if it is a kind of a paradise, a utopia, then why would anybody ever think of getting out of that state of nature and form a civil society? A civil society, if it's the right kind, now we'll come to that. We haven't come to that. But theoretically, a civil society is superior to the state of nature. Yes, sir?
Yes, in your early part of your lecture, you talked about specific law in regard to the law of nature that man would act according to life. I wonder if you could clarify what you mean, you know, by life and not in relation to law. You know,
the license is the opposite of law. When a person acts without regard to any restraints on him, but he acts in a passion, according to his will, he is a law unto himself. Then in that case, he is not acting under a law, he's not acting according to reason, because he's not acting like a man, he's acting like a beast. Animals too do what they want. A man is supposed to act as he is supposed to act, as he ought to act. The law of nature is a guide for action because it is the law of reason. And it is made by God, according to Locke. Now, we went through that, the whole development of the concept of the law of reason, which is the law of nature, which was made by God, who also made the laws operative in the physical universe. So when he made man, he made him in a way which will make it possible for him, by the use of reason, to discover the laws by which he should live. Yes?
You said that this state of nature
Well, I think I get the point. Now, I don't mean that facetiously. The commandment, thou shalt not kill, is not the total law of the Bible. There are many conditions under which a person may kill, may even have a duty to kill. So that the commandment, thou shalt not kill, is simply a starting point. It's a very important starting point. It's a basic premise. It's a fundamental conception. But you don't stop there. There are wars that are proper and wars that are improper. If a horde of wild people overrun a settlement, then of course the people in the settlement have a right to protect themselves and, if necessary, to kill those who would kill them. There is nothing in the Bible which says thou shalt not kill in self-defense. The law is made as one by which men should live, not by which men should be killed. That's basic to an understanding of the Bible. And there is certainly, outside of the revealed law, to which is the one that you refer to, which is the commandment, the understanding that thou shalt not kill was a law even before the Ten Commandments were proclaimed at Sinai. Pharaoh wasn't acting justly and rightly in accordance with any law when he ordered the Hebrew male children to be killed. The midwives knew better than Pharaoh as to what was required under those circumstances. They hadn't stood at the foot of Mount Sinai. They knew nothing about Ten Commandments. When Cain killed Abel, God did not pin a medal on Cain. Cain had not stood at the foot of Mount Sinai. He didn't need a commandment, thou shalt not kill. He was made a man, and therefore he should have known that he had no right to kill. So there's no conflict here. I think the Bible assumes a natural law. God, when he made man, made him in his own image. So what does that mean? Does it mean that man can behave as God wouldn't want him to behave? That he would violate, shatter that image which he has? Well, now, let's try to move along. Now, there are other reasons besides the one that we've been discussing why men move into a civil society from out of a state of nature. And these reasons relate to the very important Lockean conception of property. Property plays a central leading role in the thought of Locke, and it has played ever since that same role in the development of our political thought. In Chapter 5, section 26, and the following sections. God, who has given the world to men in common, that is in the state of nature, all men live in common, has also given them reason. Again, it's the concept we've been talking about, to make use of it to the best advantage of life and convenience. That's to make use of the world to the best advantage of life and convenience. The earth and all that is therein is given to men for the support and comfort of their being. And though all the fruits it naturally produces and the beasts that it feeds belong to mankind in common, as in the state of nature, all things are in common, as they are produced by the spontaneous hand of nature, and nobody has originally a private dominion exclusive of the rest of mankind in any of them, as they are thus in the natural state, yet being given for the use of men, there must, of necessity, be a means to appropriate them some way or other before they can be of any use or at all beneficial to any particular man. Now, the fruit or venison which nourishes the wild Indian who knows no enclosure and is still a tenant in common must be his and so his, that is a part of him, that another can no longer have any right to it. As given the state of nature, everything is held in common. But if everything is held in common and I have no right to any particular part of it because it is all held in common, it's like, say, a public park. I have no right to any part of it, or a city hall, which is a public building, but I have no right to any part of it, then, of course, the whole thing is useless. And in nature, I could die of hunger if I can't appropriate any part of it. So Locke says, it must follow that there must be the right to appropriate what you need. And then that becomes private property. Whatever I take out of the common wealth, which is literally the meaning of that word commonwealth, it's wealth held in common. Whatever I take out of that and appropriate to myself becomes my property. Otherwise, life would be impossible. And then he goes on, though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor, now here comes one of the most fruitful concepts in modern time, Marx, and the very opposites of Marx have used this notion. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. As my body is my own. It's my property. But then again, if I don't do anything, I'll starve, I'll die. I must work. The labor of my body, the work of my hands, must also be my property. Because my body needs what my hands will accomplish. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state of that nature has provided and left it in, and he has mixed his labor with it and joined to it something that is his own, as if I mix my sweat, my thought, into an object which nature has produced, then it becomes my own, because I have mixed myself with it. I assimilate it then to my body. And thereby makes it his property. It's the labor theory of value, labor theory of property. It being by him removed from the common state nature placed it in, it has by this labor something annexed to it that excludes the common right of other men. Once I have done this, once I have mixed my labor with it, then other men are excluded, and this object is totally my own. For this labor being the unquestionable property of the laborer, it's my sweat, it's my hands, it's my thought. Nobody can question that that's my property. No man but he can have a right to what that is one's joined to, at least where there is enough and is good left in common for others, at least insofar as I don't appropriate everything, I don't monopolize everything. He that is nourished by the acorns he picks up under an oak, or the apples he gathers from the trees, has certainly appropriated them to himself. Nobody can deny this, but that the nourishment is his. I ask then, when do they begin to be his? When he digested it? When he ate it? When he boiled it? Or when he brought them home? Or when he picked them up? And it is plain, if the first gathering made them not his, nothing else could. As if I have no right to the apples I have picked up, then I have no right that I could develop at any later point. That labor put a distinction between them and common, that is common property, the commonwealth. That added something to them more than nature. The common mother of all had done, and so they became his private right. The labor that was mine, removing them out of that common state they were in, has fixed my property in them. The apples become my private property. Now, from that he develops the notion that the protection of that property, so that I might enjoy it, requires civil government. And then that gets tied in again with the power of the execution of the law of nature. It's a very neatly developed system with elementary concepts, but you put the pieces together, and this is why I had to be maybe a little bit abrupt here to some students, because I don't want to be diverted. The bricks are just a few in number, but you put them together and you have an edifice which has in some ways influenced, if not dominated, political theory for centuries. Well, on Friday we will continue with this.